Maybe to begin, the subtitle of Monument of Sugar is How to Use Artistic Means to Elude Trade Barriers. It also is the case that with Gross Realm that you're also trying to make legible a variety of borders and landscapes that mm-hmm. would normally not be visible. So there's a really interesting way in which you're using artistic means to make visible borders and to elude and evade other borders or trade barriers.
Mm-hmm.
Is this like a practice, or is there a methodology here?
Yeah, I think you can say that. Actually, also, we work in the visual arts, and then usually our work is installation.
Mm-hmm.
So the work is composed of different parts, and we also like that the viewer kind of shuffles back and forth between these different domains,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of reflecting also our interest in borders. That is kind of but I think it came about from Europe, and especially the Netherlands, also being so inward looking,
mm-hmm.
and that we thought, like, we live in a globalized world, and fear is making, like, societies very introvert and introspective, and then we thought it would be interesting to see how different domains relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that basically came. So that's the structure of the work, and also kind of the base of our interest in borders.
And there's clearly there's a political aspect to making legible things that are not supposed to
mm-hmm.
be seen or typically resist being able to be seen. I mean, could you talk a bit more about that? The politics of making legible these kind of invisible landscapes?
Yeah, well, there's this maybe I can refer to Jacques Rancière. Do you know
mm-hmm.
He has this really nice quote about the working of the police. And the police is not like the police on the street stopping you, but it's like a kind of agency defining what is to be seen by whom. And he has this quote, like, move along, there's nothing to see. So that's kind of the people who define what can be seen. It's their motto, so to speak. And I think for arts, or in his theory, aesthetics is kind of the moment where you break open this distribution of the sensible and kind of redirect the gaze and show something that is otherwise not allowed to be seen.
And so how, I mean, I know that I had the chance to see your work last night, but so how concretely do you do this? You do this through these kind of horizontal pans and these vertical pans?
Yeah, well, basically in Gross Realm, we applied in many different ways to get permission to film border landscapes. And these border landscapes are military zones, so you're actually not allowed to make photographs there. And but after we went through this whole procedure of applying, then we have a kind of freedom to explore the landscape visually. And we take that freedom also. So we don't follow the trajectory of the border, but we kind of follow the natural movement or the movement of people or anything that would strike our attention in the landscape. So we kind of try to depict how the geopolitical structure kind of imposed itself on the landscape, but not by following the structure, but like by exploring the whole landscape, the whole situation.
Can you talk a little bit about the moments where you do embody the perspective of surveillance from different ways, right? One moment in Gross Realm, you were talking about positioning yourself on a hillside amongst smugglers who would have a surveillance of the land below. In other moments, you seem to be occupying the gaze of perhaps a kind of more state or national or international surveillance
mm-hmm.
quality of looking down at people. So
we always saw it as a kind of counter-surveillance.
Uh-huh.
So the authorities are looking to us, and we kind of created the freedom to look back to them. Maybe I can say about the higher point of view that I think it also came in the discussion yesterday that there's a lot of films being made from a very subjective point of view and following individual cases and the suffering of these people in these circumstances. I think these works are really great,
mm-hmm.
but we wanted to have a really different perspective, kind of to build upon the knowledge of these stories, but then show how it's embedded in the landscape And in the landscape, you see these different traces of these stories, but it's not that we follow one story. So we wanted to really have a different perspective, to step back and to look on how these stories are inscribed in the landscape.
I mean, it's interesting that this project from 2004 and 2005 also coincide with this moment, as I think is clearly documented in the film, or perhaps it's the backdrop to the film, when the borders of Europe were actually changing.
Yeah.
And one tends to think of a border as something impassable that doesn't change, that doesn't fluctuate, that the borders of Europe would be defined. But it seems, from what I understand, that your project was also about understanding how Europe itself is changing, and you wanted to kind of look at the fringes of Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were kind of surprised that Europe has this really strict border policy, but then there's so strong cultural relativism that you can really wonder what it is that needs to be protected. That actually drew us to the boundaries. And then these boundaries are like what brings us together, but then you're not allowed to see them. So that was kind of... But it was interesting to find out that when we were researching the specific borders, that many of them were still contested or had been recently moved. For example, the border between Poland and Ukraine, it was actually the whole Polish territory was moved after the Second World War to the west. So a part of what's now Ukraine used to be Poland, and there's a lot of traffic still over that border. So this border is only like 50 years old. And then, and now Poland joined the European Union, so now suddenly this is also part of Europe. But there's still no clear definition. For example, also about the discussion if Turkey should be a member of the European Union. That's really a discussion about the identity of Europe. Yeah.
But also the border with Spain and Morocco.
Yeah, also contested. Yeah. Also, no, like for instance, nobody or not so many people knew that there were two Spanish enclaves in the Moroccan territory. But what even less people knew is that Morocco doesn't recognize these territories, these two enclaves. So you find out by interacting, or we found out by interacting with these governments, how the political situation is on these sites, and that these borders are actually really contested.
What is there a relationship between these films and kind of something like advocacy? Could you see, I mean, as one who's very much interested in and troubled by the politics of mobility and the construction of geopolitical borders, I wanted to find, I think I found in your films, something that seemed like a form of advocacy for being critically engaged with these kinds of questions or tensions. Would that be a misreading? Am I projecting into the films?
I don't know the word advocacy.
Advocacy? What would be a way to translate advocacy?
Not the word in Dutch, but...
Perhaps not something, maybe perhaps not as strong as activism, but as kind of encouraging an active engagement with the issues at hand, not mm-hmm. just consuming the film.
It's also a kind of support, right? Supporting a cause. Usually mm-hmm. we think of advocacy as sometimes representing a voice, you know, or taking some type of stand mm-hmm. to make an issue public.
I think it's like, especially because now many countries in Europe are so inward looking and don't watch what's going on at the borders. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely one of the motives for us to start investigating what was going on there.
Can you talk maybe a little bit about your research process? So you chose three different contested border sites. You know, how you came upon those ones? Were there other sites that you were considering? And, you know, did you have personal ties or connections? I know that it's an elaborate process of applying for permissions once you had decided on those particular locations. Mm-hmm. But how did you get to that point?
And could you also describe which of those, what those three locations were?
Yeah. The first location was, I must say, it's an organic process, but not completely organic, of course. But so some of it had a personal background. And for example, I already visited Ceuta when I was 18, I think, with my brother. We traveled on a kind of Euro rail pass. So I knew this this enclave, and I was really fascinated by it already back then. And you had a friend in Poland, like a really good friend, and so we kind of knew these two places. But we started the whole project with our friend Darek Sendel, who fled the regime in, what was it, 86 or 87, to the Netherlands. 87. And then he returned in the 90s. And we visited with him several, we returned to Poland, to Warsaw. We visited several of the border locations in Poland to see the landscape, because we wanted to look to the outside. So we needed a kind of elevated point of view. So we looked at different places where this could be possible, and also like places that would have an interesting historical background. Like, for example, the place where we actually filmed was on the way to Lvov. And Lvov is like a really famous and big city in Ukraine where a lot of Polish people live. So this road is very much traveled over by people who have historical ties to the other side. In Ceuta, it was it was really because I knew the place.
But we visited also other...
We visited other places, but so in the end we chose for Rebenne because of that reason.
And the Turkey, the...
Initially we wanted to film an outside border of, or like, an outside border of Turkey. So not the border between Greece and Turkey, but like to Syria. And we tried really several places, Azerbaijan. Armenia, we didn't try. Georgia, we tried.
Iran.
And we really tried all of them, and the Turkish embassy was really supportive of the project. But each time, our applications ended up with a certain general, who, without motivation, just denied our our filming. And that's actually so that the army or the general is overpowering the politics. That's kind of one of the things that makes it difficult for Turkey to enter the European Union.
And so that's revealed in the publication that accompanies the installation of the film.
Yeah, so we published some of the letters, like the email of the Turkish embassy, where they say, like, all your requests have been refused by this general and he didn't give a motivation, which is, I mean... When there were Dutch diplomats who saw the film and also read the publication, and this was like also like a heavy, heavy thing.
It's interesting to read in one of those letters how, in the case of Turkey, your application was seen as possibly able to support their entry to the EU, or they perceived it as a means by which to support their application to the EU. And I was wondering, like, how did you respond to that? Was it kind of something that was humorous? Was it something that suggested that, in a way, your film had been instrumentalized as something that could be politically useful?
No, we didn't really mind, because we knew there were many forces at play. So we were just really curious what would happen. Because everybody, because we had been doing research before we started the formal trajectory, but it was kind of, the concept of the film was that we would do this formal trajectory and then see what would come out of that. But everybody said, no, you should not do that. You should just go there and then negotiate on the side with the military who's present, and then you might be able to do something. But if you go through the official channels, you will surely strand somewhere. So we didn't really mind that there were some people who used it as a kind of, for their own end. And we thought that was kind of interesting.
I mean, would you say your project is evasive in the sense that you're trying to find, like, loopholes? You're trying to find the means by which you can film something that you're not supposed to be able to film? Would that be a characteristic of your practice, or is that just a necessary strategy?
Well, I think, like, maybe it's also because we are from a really regulated society, the Netherlands. Like, everything is very bureaucratic. That is kind of our second nature, to always find, navigate through these regulations. And also to show, like, the rudeness, but the vredeheid, how do you say that? The cruelness of these type of regulations.
But to show it by using them to subvert them. So you subvert the regulations by mimicking or by adopting kind of creative tactics.
So we try to to be in charge, so to speak, instead of being being ruled by them. For maybe I can give an example of the structure I was referring to. We had an exhibition space in our house for a certain time, and one of the projects that we developed was with Marjetica Potrič. She's a Slovenian architect and artist, and we live in a building designed by Hans Kohlhoff. It's a really rigid, I mean, it's a beautiful building, but it's kind of a rigid design, and it's completely protected, so nothing is possible. And we live in a social housing apartment on the top floor with an amazing 7 meter high ceiling because it's kind of an arrest space. But there are hardly any windows, so it's a very dark apartment. And in the beginning, when we just moved in there, we applied to have roof windows so that we would have more light. But it was the roof landscape was protected by the architect, so that was not possible. And then when Marjetica Potrič, she proposed that we would make a platform on the roof, kind of a roof terrace, with a staircase going along the house front leading to our balcony. And then we thought, this is really a challenge, because we thought that we would never be able to build that as architecture or like as a roof terrace, but as an artwork. Mm-hmm. We thought we might be able to circumvent all the regulation. Mm-hmm. And then it took 4 years to kind of get public funding for this extension of our private space and navigate all the regulation. And then it was there, so we installed it in 2008. And what was really interesting was that when we were installing it, people from the neighborhood came to us, and for instance, the bike repairman, and he had been applying to extend his store, but each time the permit was rejected for some kind of bureaucratic reason. And when he saw that we managed, he got like really new energy to kind of find holes in the regulation.
That's what was very striking too in Monument for Sugar, when you talk about the legal codes, right? And using the status of art and laws around art to be able to elude the trade barrier because it's not going to count as a kind of commodity exchange. But then when you get to Nigeria, the laws there prevent the artwork or the monument from being exported for reasons. Yeah. Right. Other reasons. So I don't know. Is engaging with the law, you know, and this type of, is this part of your research more generally? Just to follow up with this idea of evasion and what you're evading.
I think so. I think it's a recurring thing, and also in the project that we're now working on, we're kind of trying to explore how these laws that have been imposed upon us from above, how they work on the ground, so to speak, and how they're experienced by people, and how you can circumvent them. But circumventing then is also a way of finding out where they are, and so it's also a kind of mapping in a way. It's kind of a method of mapping by trying to find the holes.
It's like an experimental,
right?
An experimental process by which you're able to map the possibilities for being evasive, finding loopholes,
and also meeting new barriers. Then
that is useful for the next kind of stage in these projects, because all of your projects seem like processes.
Yeah,
it's not that you filmed one border; you filmed a variety of border zones.
Yeah, and we also try to learn, like if we ask permission. Well, in the beginning when we started, we thought like we could just ask Brussels, you know, like the capital of Europe, if we could film at all the borders. But it really didn't work like that, because all the countries still have a say about their own territory. So then when we applied at the... There was an interesting event, actually. When we applied at the Polish border, they also told us that because there are so good relationships with Ukraine, that we also had to apply... to the Ukrainian embassy to get permission to film their landscape. But it was a really strange permission that we needed, because normally the film permission is connected to a visa. But we would stay on Polish soil, so we didn't need the visa, we just needed the permit to film the landscape. And when we went to the other location, to Ceuta, which was the second, then we thought, oh, we learned from this, so we should always apply at both sides of the border. And then we found out that the Moroccans, they didn't recognize Ceuta as Spanish territory, so they would never give us permission.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, yeah, so we took our experiences from one side to the other, but each time it turned out to work out differently.
So it'd be great to talk about Monument of Sugar more, but on the question of grass realm and the question of a border to you is something physical, or it's also something social, cultural, economic?
Yeah, there's more, it can also be a code or something like in the social system, so to speak.
And so is that one way to read your film project? That on the one hand, there are these very slow, almost panoramic shots of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But at the same time, there are these kind of human motifs and these other elements of mobility and movement, or the lack of mobility and movement, that communicate that a border is not just like a line
mm-hmm.
cutting through the landscape. It's also a relationship, in a way, between two different communities and cultures and economies. Would you say that you're trying to, in a way, communicate both in the film?
I'm sorry, I think I did.
In Grass Realm, the film, I mean, on the one hand, it's a visual. It's visual.
Yeah.
Your relationship to it, it's a silent film. Your relationship to it is very much through a spectatorial kind of
mm-hmm.
approach, but and the landscapes that define these border regions are very much what one sees.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that there's also this more subtle narrative that one finds there, which is that a border is not just the physical line.
But that it's I think maybe I can say that it's not only us finding these loopholes, but there's many people trying to work with these kind of imposed structures and finding ways to deal with them for their own, to be able to continue their own living or their own practice.
And yet these moments where you have the human figures, we were talking about this a little bit, they're so small compared to either shots of machines or buildings or landscape. And here I'm wondering about how beauty and aesthetics work, because you know your work has been described as very painterly, and you have a background in painting, and because there's a kind of visual pleasure, right, in the lingering and in the panning and all the color and the lushness of this image that's striking us. How do you think about that type of aesthetic? I don't know if it becomes an aestheticization, right, of the border, where the pleasure goes. As a viewer, I found myself often troubled or confused, about what to make of the image, especially with respect to how beautiful the palette can be with the landscape. And then you have the theme that we've been talking about of the politics and the ethics, how a border can be porous or obstructionist, right? And there's a certain type of intellectual engagement with ideas that's very political. How to make that fit with, this aesthetic beauty that also seems really important.
So maybe you can also define a border there.
Mm.
So there's the border between the political and the aesthetics.
Yes.
And they seem to be opposing, and there seems to be a paradox. But we really kind of like that you kind of try to bridge this gap somehow, and even if it gives you conflicts.
Yes.
So that was actually deliberately one of the things that we wanted to do, to kind of see how politics and aesthetics can, how they go together or not go together. And because also, for example, like what I just described, that we were able to get the permit to build the lookout, you're the artistic exception, of course. I mean, the shopkeeper of the bikes, he could not use this artistic exception. So there's always this, as an artist, you're part of the world, but you're also kind of standing aside of it all. And this gives a kind of ambivalent position. And we kind of want to express that also in the work by kind of... Dr. Spitzler, you said?
That's a bit... With regard to monuments, with regard to Monument of Sugar, the subtitle, How to Use Artistic Means to Elude Trade Barriers, I was wondering if you could also talk about how these artistic means were also the means by which you were implicated by trade barriers and compromised by trade barriers. You were at once trying to elude them, but you were also completely like kind of marked by them.
Yeah, and they become a burden. So.
Yeah, and it's not unrelated to Grossraum, where you're working, you're embedded in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
To make these borders legible, to film them, you also have to work through the very institutions, the militarized kind of institutions that you're also trying to, in some level, critique or evade. So can you talk about how you're, with Monument of Sugar, how you're at once eluding trade barriers, but you're also completely, like, kind of caught up in them?
You mean, like, about what happened? What that we had to pay? You mean like specifically that we had to pay taxes, more in general how it is to be
philosophically, perhaps, but also practically. Like the whole project is an attempt to elude trade barriers, but at the same time it's completely dependent on these trade barriers, and it completely shapes everything that results as a practice, as a project.
Well, also that you foreground failure a lot in that.
Yeah.
There's a certain type of irony and humor that's directed toward yourself through the text as it's describing the process, right, of both trying so hard to make this work happen, and you have a plan of how you're going to elude the trade barriers and how you're going to reconstruct these blocks of sugar and ship them back, and you're trying to get the permissions or make this happen, but it doesn't work so neatly, right? It falls apart on some level.
Well, maybe I can say about it that we spoke also yesterday with Mimi Scheller about it, and she said it's kind of a fable, the whole story, and that's that we kind of recognize that because, of course, we had our experiences there on the site, but we kind of aestheticized them for the film, so to speak. Also, the narrative is aestheticized. And we wanted to have a kind of narrative where in the beginning you think it's a research piece. So you think like, oh, there's this research about the subsidized economy, and then it's like kind of neutral. Or then at a certain moment, you find out as a reader that we're not all knowing, and that we start making mistakes. And we kind of hope that the viewer is an independent person and would kind of distance himself from us. So that's also why we made this structure of that you have pieces of narrative and then pieces of autonomous footage. So you could like kind of think over what has been written in the narrative, and you could kind of find your own position and relate to the naiveness of the narrative. I think when we started off, it was also like, I don't know how it's in the States, but in Europe there's this strong discourse about artistic research, and then suddenly artists pretend to be like researchers. And I think this is all really interesting, but artists are not academics. So what we set out to do with Monument of Sugar is that we said like we want to make a sculpture. So that's kind of the end goal. And even though there's a lot of research involved, the research doesn't follow the research, so to speak, but it follows the sculpture, so the artistic trajectory.
But if this is a sculpture, it's a sculpture that's not being made in the privacy of a studio.
No, it's a drifting studio.
It's a drifting studio, which is to say that it's a studio that's completely embedded and implicated
by
a very different series of questions.
It's completely unfree. So it's a conceptual piece, so to speak, but then the concept is not like a pure structure, but it gets input from like all the circumstances that we meet.
So could you talk more then about like this drifting studio and why a drifting studio?
How can I say, like, maybe I can relate to what was interesting for us was that when we produced the whole piece, we found a statement by Lawrence Wiener, and it said 1,000 German marks worth medium bulk material translated or transferred from one country to another, and that was actually what we had been doing. But then we had made our hands dirty, so to speak, because we had been actually doing that and then meeting all the things that you meet on the way. So the fact that we had our studio, like the studio moved with us, so when we traveled, and all these locations, they gave a kind of input on the on the sculpture, which in the end was the result. So this kind of beautiful concept, which you can make out in your studio, if you move into the real world, it gets like smudgy, and it, like the cubes actually. So we thought the cubes were like sticky, and also they get less rectangular, but they get like.
Is there an argument here for the importance of an artist getting dirty, like, you know?
Yeah, I think it's kind of easy to sit in your home and to think of these concepts, but if you move in the real world, then you need to kind of work with the material and the political systems, or they're the material too. You have to kind of find a way to deal with them, and then you make on-site decisions, which may be really stupid if you look at them in retrospective, but they're part of the process.
You spoke before about how the bureaucratic culture of the Netherlands has influenced your decision on how to practice. Would you say that in the Netherlands you're also resisting a certain type of artistic practice? Or
well, the artistic practice in the Netherlands is a difficult. Well, it's really aesthetic and very little political. And when it is political, then it's used by what I was just trying to explain. Like, for example, cities giving assignments to artists to work in like underdeveloped neighborhoods, but with the idea that they will gentrify. Yeah. So we always try to be a bit away, keep a bit away from that.
I wonder if you would agree or disagree with Monument of Sugar being a work of post-colonial art, because you're tracking through the narrative also the history of sugar, mm-hmm. sugar production and labor and slave labor, and there's such a visual focus on whiteness, right, on the screen, the whiteness of the sugar cubes, the neatness of this, and you travel to Nigeria, and then you see very few human bodies for the first part of the film. A lot of focus on machinery and a little bit more on hands as we move through. But then you have these laboring bodies and African bodies that become part of the scene and the landscape of sugar production that you're shooting in Lagos, which, you know, makes me think that in a way, you know, this is very much a post-colonial project because it's a reflection on a certain contemporary moment of how globalization works with this particular commodity that has a very disturbing and complex history around labor and movement, right, across the Atlantic and Europe. Is that something that
resonates? Definitely it definitely resonates, and also that like if you're in an overdeveloped country like the Netherlands, then all like physical labor has disappeared somehow from view. But it is being done, you know.
Yes.
But it's hidden. So it's hidden in other countries. And that's also why we kind of really showed that it was being done in Nigeria, and why we focused on the machines and like the empty like facilities and sugar plants in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So that was... and also what you describe about the research, I quite recognize that.
I just found the image of the cube so chilling because, you know, there's one moment where in the text you're describing the slave labor, and then you have the machines processing with lots of beats that suddenly look like skulls or body parts, or you have these cubes that look like tombs or graves as they're piling up, you know, and it's so pristine and so white, and you're the distance that you have, and you know, between what's being said and what's being shown, and what seems very aestheticized on the one hand, but that very process of aestheticization seems to be making a very powerful statement about the messiness, you know, that's not being shown when you have a cube of sugar that you place.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also like a. There's this other side of modernism, so you have the rigid forms, but then there's a lot which you don't see, which was necessary to produce these forms, but which happens out of sight.
If it's a post-colonial practice or a form of critique, it's also a critique of minimalism?
It was, actually, yeah. Also because minimalism is, and also conceptual art, they're like... They tend to see the product as a kind of standardized material, but they don't engage with where the materials came from. And that was always kind of difficult to understand for us, also because it's from this period that everybody was politically engaged. So how come that the minimal artist, which used only the material, would not express that engagement in their work? And also, I think it was also for us conceptual art. When it was first developed, it was a critical approach, I think, towards the genie and the
yeah, how do you say it in English?
Yeah.
The
genius cult and the handwriting, and that the artist is someone really special, and in conceptual art, of course, this is all disappeared. But nowadays, conceptual art is still kind of the main practice from many artists. So they think of the idea. I can remember that there was this piece by Jens Hanning, and he had a shield installed in the Netherlands saying Afghanistan is so about 5,000 kilometers away from here, and it was like a regular shield at the highway. But then he never negotiated with these local governments to get this shield installed. So he just thought of the idea and then had someone else produce the piece. And I find this actually really strange way of operating now that labor is being moved to other places, and that the conceptual work has become so,
alienated from the conditions of production,
right,
and the politics and questions concerning the politics of production.
Like we have this Tascam field recorder, and the idea is from California, and then the parts are produced in China, and it's assembled in Japan. So then California is the head, so to speak.
So craft is something that is important for you. We were talking about getting hands dirty, but the idea of traveling, being on location, and last night we were talking a little bit about even the heaviness of the camera, or, you know, your decision to shoot in 16mm or 35mm, or to include the projector in the installation site, and what it might mean to even shift away into digital form as it becomes less viable or less possible to work within this very physical kind of medium that seems to speak to the idea of being present, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, can you say a little bit about how you like your work to be shown, or what you see as the future for what how you're going to have?
Well, the future is a difficult question. We're actually really working on that. But maybe I can describe the problem. Because we are always really resisting this hidden labor. For example, if you have a beamer, then it's a black box, and you don't know who made it. It has been made, but nobody knows. You know, it was produced somewhere else.
You mean the beamer, you mean projector?
The video projector. Sorry, it's a beamer in Dutch.
I was thinking BMW.
It's like a closed box, and you don't know what happens inside. So we very much like to show our works on film projectors, because then you see that the machine is working for you so that you can see the image. And otherwise you tend to take it for granted that the image is shown, and you don't think about that it's produced, the image. And so that's actually kind of an important part of our work. It also connects to why we want to show the production process of the pieces. So we're very much engaged with showing the production of the work. But now that showing on film in museums is really hardly possible. We just had a show in the Boijmans Museum, and it was up for 2 months, and I think one work they deinstalled after 2 weeks because it just broke all the time and they didn't have personnel to fix it, and the other piece wasn't running for 6 weeks, so we didn't even have a show. I mean, It's increasingly more difficult to show in these formats, and also museums and galleries are refusing to show in the formats increasingly. So we need to kind of rethink how to move on. But for us, it's kind of strange to show these pieces, which were really developed for showing in a certain manner on a projector in a space. But they're also without sound, so if you have the projector, then you have the sound of the projector. So to just show them on a video projector would be such a big compromise that the work wouldn't survive. So now we're kind of thinking, for the new works, so how can we kind of have this idea that the work was produced and that the image is produced, but then inside the film, so it doesn't depend on the presence of the projector. But that's a really complicated task we're still in the middle of. Yeah.
And you still think of, I mean, I know you've just explained that these are not just films, they're films installed in a space, with materials, documents, publications, the sound of the projector, legible, all of this. But you think of film in a way as a crucial way to communicate with the public in a way that you think that other mediums perhaps do not enable? You think of it as a bit democratic or an egalitarian medium in a way that cultivates a culture of viewing and of thinking?
I don't know if it's more democratic. I don't think it's more democratic, but it's more clear somehow. So it doesn't hide so much. It's not black boxing, like for us. So I mean, it's black boxing because you need to do everything in the dark. But that's the only black boxing.
It's more understandable.
Yeah, it's more understandable. And I think it's very important that you understand how things are being made or being produced. And I think, that's kind of something that's very important for us, because that's actually what we want to kind of trigger in the audience, that they also engage in how things are being produced or how reality is being produced, because that's of course the next step.